All right. That's good. I say that because I'm constantly meeting people who've been here once, twice, three times, and I think you should know that, and I need to meet you. And so, 2 weeks from now, we've clustered everything, like Charlie said, around this one weekend, and let me reiterate that. If you're a leader of any kind in this church, please sign up for our lead meeting on Saturday morning the 23rd from 8:30 to noon. It's going to be great. If you're a Christian and you have never been baptized, Jesus said he wants all of his followers to be baptized. So if you've never done that, I remember I waited 7 years. Then it's time for you to be baptized on the 24th on that morning. If you have been here like 1 year or less, like you started coming about a year ago to a week ago. How many have made this your church like in the last year or so? Let me just see your hands real quick. A bunch of you. So that's why we're having this lunch right after church on the 24th. Great. Looking forward to that. We are in the middle of the book of John. So please turn to the Gospel of John. We are at what I would call the hinge chapter. There's 21 chapters in John, and this one is a hinge. It's John spends almost half of his gospel on the last week of Jesus' earthly life. It's amazing. So chapter 11 here is the hinge between his earthly ministry and his week of passion at the very end. And we're going to see some amazing things in this wonderful, wonderful chapter. This includes the last sign. John says at the end of his book that he could have written a lot of things, but he chose to record some signs that showed that Jesus was the Christ and proved that he was, and this is the last one. So he started, his first sign was at a wedding. His last sign is at a funeral. In many ways, Jesus is the new Moses. Moses, remember, he had signs that he gave to Egypt. God worked some miracles through Moses, and the very first sign that Moses gave was when he changed the water to blood. Jesus changed the water to wine. The last sign of Moses was the death of the firstborn, and here the last sign is bringing someone who was dead back to life. So water to wine, healing a child, healing a paralytic, feeding 5,000 people, walking on water, healing a blind man in chapter 9, and now raising Lazarus. It's not the only time Jesus raised someone who had died. He raised the widow's son in a little town called Nain, and then he also raised Jairus' daughter. But here, he raises a very close friend of his who had died. We also have one of his I am statements. If we can go back. And that is that he said, I'm the bread of life. I'm the light of the world. Last week we looked at the fact that he said, I'm the gate of the sheep. I'm the good shepherd. He talked about life in metaphors, and here he talks about life itself. He's going to say in this passage in John 11, I am the resurrection. I am life itself. And so to give you a visual picture, I'm a visual person. I need some help with that kind of thing. So here's a map of Israel. The north, Galilee, the Sea of Galilee, that's where Jesus spent a lot of his time teaching, doing miracles. And now he's going to focus on Jerusalem, which is in the south. It's near the Dead Sea. Actually, from Jerusalem to the Dead Sea is only about 25 miles. There's a desert in between. And he has tried to distance himself from the city of Jerusalem because it is not safe. I've been thinking, it's so ironic that the one place on earth that should have been the safest place and that should have recognized who Jesus was the most dangerous place for him. There's a broader, larger drama going on in Jesus' life because there's an enemy and there's this sense of hostility in Jerusalem among those who should have recognized and welcomed him. So he had to get away from Jerusalem. And so he, at the end of chapter 10, had gone to where John the Baptist had been baptizing. And ironically, Jesus' ministry started out where, you know, John was baptizing. And it ends where John had been baptizing across the Jordan. He's going to be drawn into a place called Bethany. There's two Bethanies, but there's one that's really a suburb of Jerusalem. If you go there today, it takes just a few minutes to get from downtown Jerusalem to Bethany. It takes 5 minutes to get to Bethlehem. They're suburbs. They're not very far apart. But again, it's dangerous for him to go there. We're going to see after he does this miracle today, he's going to have to leave to go up to a place called Ephraim just to get away because it's so hostile. I was thinking about this. It's like every superhero movie you've ever heard of, there's always this enemy, right? Who's always hostile and trying to draw the powerful person, the good person, into conflict. And that person always kind of escapes somehow. But what do? Every single time, whether it's a James Bond movie or some superhero movie or Superman or whatever, they try to grab onto somebody that this person loves, right? And now they've got him because this person is so loving, they're going to risk saving that person that they do love, who's weaker. And that's what happens here. Jesus is outside the realm of Jerusalem, but something happens very close by to a good friend of his, and that's going to draw him back into the battle. We're going to see how Jesus relates to three different people, to Martha, to Mary, and to Lazarus. All these people are related. They're all living in the same house. They're three single people, brothers and sisters, Lazarus, Mary, and Martha. You've heard about Mary and Martha. You've heard about Martha's kind of a little more A-type personality, more controlled, doesn't show her emotions as much. Maybe you're like that. You know, sometimes I'm like, I don't know that I'm like Martha, but sometimes I don't cry at certain things. I never cry at a wedding. I don't know, people cry at weddings. I'm not sure, unless you've seen the bill that's coming. But and Mary's a little more withdrawn. She's more shy. She's always at Jesus' feet, always listening. And Lazarus, he doesn't say much, but he's real sick. And so it starts out in verse 1 of chapter 11, a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It talks about Mary anointing the Lord, but we're going to find out about that in the next chapter. And so the sisters sent word to Jesus saying, Lord, the one you love is sick. They didn't even mention his name. I don't know if it was because it was dangerous or he would just know. So Jesus is off in the distance, a couple days away. And by the time he gets this note, I believe Lazarus has already died. He waits a little bit, but I don't think he waits so that Lazarus will die. I think he waits because he always did things when the Father told him to do them. You know, that's probably a good lesson for us, is to do things when God tells us to do them. People were always trying to tell Jesus when to do things and what to do. And he would always say, you know, I'm listening to the Father. I'm going to do what the Father wants me to do when he wants me to do it. And so Jesus gets this note and he's with his disciples and he's, you know, off across the other side of the Jordan. And they say, well, what's it all about? Well, Lazarus is sick and actually he's fallen asleep. And I'm thinking of going back to help him. You know, it's hard to be a follower of Jesus. You're never quite sure. You know, we got what he's cut up his sleeve, and they're kind of going, well, Jesus, just recently, they tried to stone you to death in Jerusalem. This is in verse 8. And you want to go back? You know, it's real, real dangerous there. I'm not sure you're picking up on this, but it's real dangerous. And also, you know, how can we say this? But if he's just asleep, if he fell asleep, he's probably going to wake up on his own. Do you really need to go? And Jesus, you know, is using this language. And actually, Christians have picked up on this language for good reason. The idea of falling asleep. Because there's been this tremendous power called death, which has gripped us for all of our lives and all of the lives of the human race. Doesn't matter how good our drugs get. I'm on several right now because I found out that little tiny people called babies, you know, I just figured that little tiny babies' germs were not powerful, you know, enough to hurt a big, massive person like me. But evidently, little baby germs are just the same size as regular germs, so they make you sick. But it doesn't matter how long we live, the death rate has stayed pretty much the same, right? For all time, it's always 100%. We all die. And so the fear of that grips us, it says in the Bible. And yet, that has been broken by Jesus. And so this idea of falling asleep is something that the Christians came up with. In fact, when they compared the drawings in the catacombs in Rome between the Christians and the non-Christians, there was a sense with the Christians of hope and that, hey, we're going to see this person again. Just yesterday, a lot of you had this wonderful celebration service. Susan Fisher had died a week and a half ago. She actually wanted to be there at the celebration, but she passed away, and so there was a sadness, and yet there was a sense of joy because of this chapter, because of the truth of what's in this chapter. Jesus is the resurrection and the life, and so we don't make light of death, but there's something beyond it he has broken through. And so he says, you know, well, Lazarus is asleep, and they're going, well, he'll just wake up, and they go, well, no, Lazarus is dead, but I'm going to do something. And so he does. He goes to a very dangerous place. And we're going to pick it up in verse 17 through verse 44. And it says, on his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Now, Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Mary and Martha to comfort them in the loss of their brother. Now, often when John says the Jews, he's talking about in a pejorative or negative way, Jesus' enemies, but not so here. These are just friends. These are just Jewish people that have come to mourn with the sisters. It's normal. The Jews did and still have sort of probably a healthy sense of mourning. We're like, you have this major surgery and they send you home the same day, right? That's the way we function. And often I think we treat mourning the same way, like I'll mourn for a day or two and then I should be over it. And they actually took their cue from Joseph. Back in Genesis 50, Joseph, his father was Jacob, his dad died, and he took 7 days to grieve and to mourn. And so they came up with this Jewish custom, which they still have today. It's called sitting Shiva. And Shiva means seven. So even today, a Jewish person might say, would you come and sit Shiva with me in my home for 7 days? The first day, three are like real heavy, and the next four go on. And then they actually have a kind of mourning that goes on for the rest of the month. So that 7 day period is what's going on here. They even had a legend, which wasn't biblical, but they said, you know, the spirit kind of hovers around the body for 3 days, and then on the fourth day, it's gone. But that wasn't a biblical idea. It was just one of their sort of customs. But they did say back then, even if you're really poor, you have to hire 2 flute players and a wailing woman. So they had professional mourners back then. They wanted to not just grieve and mourn and be quiet, but they wanted mourning flute music and people wailing, people that were like strangers that you would pay just to wail all day long. And so that's going on here. And so that's the situation that Jesus is coming into. Mourning, grieving, this brother Lazarus, one of Jesus' best friends, has died. And so Martha hears that Jesus is coming, and she takes off. She goes out to meet him. Jesus isn't quite into town or quite near their house. And I think this is a place that Jesus went often. I think Jesus was single. These people were single. I think often when he just wanted to get away from the crowds and just hang out, chill out with his friends, he would go to their house. So it's a place that he went often. And so Mary stays at home. Martha runs out and she says, look at what she says. Lord, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died. Now, we don't know the inflection. Everybody's always got, you know, their own take on this. I don't think she was, like, angry at him, like, way to go, Jesus. Thanks a lot for showing up late. I think she was more in regretting the fact that he was too far away. Because I think Jesus, when he got the note, I think Lazarus had already died. And so she's like, I wish you'd been around. I wish you'd been here. My brother wouldn't have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. Now, I don't think she's saying, would you please raise him up? because of what comes right after this. I think she's just saying, I still believe in you. I still love you. I wish you'd been here. Oh, I'm still grieving. And Jesus says, well, your brother will rise again. Now, this almost sounds like one of those things that we say when we don't know what to say, you know, when you go to a funeral or something, or somebody's grieving and you don't know what to say, so you just, that you feel like you're going to say something. So you say something and it's kind of like, well, he's going to rise again. And she, that's kind of the way she takes it. She goes, yeah, I know. I know he's going to rise again in the resurrection at the last day. I know. But that doesn't tell me right now. It hurts. He's gone. I know that'll happen. But Jesus goes, it's not exactly what I meant. I am the resurrection and the life. Martha, I am. That's the name of God, Yahweh. I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this? And so he's talking to her in theological terms, and he's asking her what she believes. I got an Evite the other day to go to this thing, which was actually last night. And on an Evite, it usually says, here's the deal. Are you coming? And there's always three options, right? Yes, no, maybe. Somebody coming with me, you know? That third one, the maybe, I don't think that's one of Jesus' options here. You believe, yes or no? I've got a friend who used to go visit people in prison and tell them about Jesus. And so he goes to this prison, and he's talking to this guy about Jesus. And they've talked for quite a while, and so he says, well, would you like to accept Jesus now that you know who he is and what he'll do for you? And the guy goes, And so they're done, and my friend writes down on a piece of paper that so-and-so rejected Jesus. And the guy said, what are you writing down there? He goes, well, I wrote down that you rejected Jesus. He goes, well, I didn't reject him. You know, I'm just kind of thinking about it. Maybe, I'm not sure. And he goes, well, no, there's no maybe with Jesus. It's like you either receive him or you don't. Now, I understand. There's times in our lives when we're examining Christianity and answering questions, and that's good. But when it comes down to it, at the end, we only have one life to live, and you will either have accepted Jesus or not. And that's what Jesus is asking. Do you believe me, Martha? You either do or you don't. And she says, yes, I believe you're the Christ. You are the Son of God. The one who is to come into this world, the one that fulfills every promise we ever have. So I thought it might be good for you to hear from somebody more recent. This was 2,000 years ago. This is a woman that believes. And I asked another woman, Mary Kay Lee, to come up and tell her story about meeting Jesus and coming to faith in him. And Mary Kay and I... we're having lunch the other day, and that was not my purpose in the lunch. You know, we were just talking, right? And this is Mary Kay Lee, and when I first got here like 8 years ago, I heard there's this woman named Mary Kay, and she loves missions. But she was a normal person also, you know, because missionaries just, we don't know what to do with them. They're a different breed, right? But she's a normal person also in her own right. And so she loves missions, and that's what she is now. She's a missionary, right?
I am.
Hard to believe, yep. But you weren't always one, right?
No.
And so just tell us who you are, first of all, and then we'll get into your story.
Okay, well, as Steve said, I'm Mary Kay Lee. I work for Bee World, which is a missions organization that goes out and teaches pastors and leaders, trains them in areas where the church is persecuted, so places where it's really hard for the Christians.
Yeah. So Mary Kay gets on like 19 flights, goes over to India, gets on 11-hour, now the 11-hour is really a true bus ride, 200 miles up into the mountains, the Himalayas, and talks to Indian women about Jesus, right?
Yep.
But you weren't always like doing stuff like that, and we went on a trip together, and she's you're a little bit more of a Martha than a Mary.
Absolutely.
And, you know, a little bit more of, she's a businesswoman, and so we were talking about her story, I asked her if she would tell you guys. So.
Okay. Well, I grew up in a home that went to church religiously. Every single Sunday we went to church. I never heard the gospel in that church. I don't think it was even preached. It was very much of a liberal church. But in any case, I never heard it. But it was just something that we did. And so I grew up, went to college, and of course all that went out the window like it does for a lot of young people. I got married, and my husband and I had two things in common pretty much. We both worked for IBM, and we both drank. We pretty much every day would go to work, and we'd come home, and we would drink, and then on the weekends we would drink more. So this went on for 8 years, and then we finally had children. Excuse me. Well, I changed very dramatically in that process. I became really almost obsessed with my children. They were such a focus in my life, and that didn't happen to my husband. I stopped drinking, and he didn't. So there was a lot of stress in the marriage, and, you know, what happened was we divorced. I mean, that was like the option that was given to us, and that's what we did. So I'm now a single mom with two little kids, and I mean little, 2 and 5 years old. They were really little, and I thought, well, you know, I need to be a good mom, and what good mothers do is take their kids to church. So I asked somebody who I knew was a Christian to recommend a church. She said, oh, this church, it's the really family-oriented, it's a good church for you. So I said, okay. So went, and, you know, two things became very evident or happened really to me right away. The first was when we would sing a hymn, like Holy, 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 I would just start weeping uncontrollably. It was like, what in the heck is this all about? And the other thing I noticed was all these people, they're very normal people, but they actually believed what they're talking about. You know, when they would read the scripture, they would act like, well, of course, we believe this. I mean, this is true. And that just amazed me. So couple of weeks, really not a very long time, went by, and my brain was just being turned inside out. I was just so driven and so compelled to figure this out when the visitation committee came to see me, right? Those of you who are old enough remember that. It was a young woman who was a missionary, and then the two old guys, I think they were deacons or elders or something, whatever. And sat on my couch, you know. Anyway, we visited for a while, but she shared the gospel with me, just plain and simple. You know, we've all sinned. No one is worthy of God's presence, of coming to heaven. The only way that you can please God is to accept his son and rely totally on him, and then you can have eternal life. And, okay, I'm a Martha. You know, I'm not a feely person, but in my brain, I heard this voice saying, this is truth. And I was like, really? Yes, this is truth. And so she didn't close the deal then, but within the next couple of weeks, I prayed the prayer with, you know, in the quiet of my bedroom. Steve and I were teasing. The next night I prayed it, and the next night I prayed it. I want to make sure it stuck. But, yeah, my whole life, I just changed from darkness to light, from lies to truth.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for telling your story.
Sure.
Let's give her a hand for doing that. We've taken trips to Africa, and I don't think I knew Mary Kay's story, but it helps because that's what happens in real life when someone comes into a relationship with Jesus Christ. And so Martha says this, and then she runs home, and she talks to her sister, Mary. And she says, Mary, and Mary's grieving, and Martha says, Jesus is here. The teacher's here, and he wants to talk to you. So she gets up, takes off. Again, she's a shy person, but she's absolutely focused on Jesus. She loves this guy. She listens to everything he says. And she got up quickly and went out to him. And Jesus hadn't yet entered the village, but he was still at the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews, who had been with Mary in the house comforting her, noticed how quickly she got up and went out,
They followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. And when Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said the exact same words that Martha said. Look at it. Exact same words. And what I love about this is that Jesus knows you, and he knows me, and he doesn't respond like a cookie cutter the same way to everybody. He's the same person with the same truth, but he responds to you in the way that you need him to. And so Martha is this A-type personality, and he talks theology with her, and Martha is absolutely grieving, and he is the God-man. He is divine and human. And you would expect him to go, you know what? This is all going to be okay. You really don't need to cry, Mary. You don't need to be, you know, all worked up. You expect God to be this non-emotional being who nothing can touch. But something very unusual happens here. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Now, that word isn't quite, I don't know that it's translated as well as it could be. It actually means angry and indignant. If you have animals or you've heard the bellowing of some big animal, that's what this word means. Or it actually means the snorting of a horse, you know, when it's all worked up. Jesus is all worked up. He is indignant. He is furious at something. What is it? That's what everybody wants to know. I think he's furious at death and the brokenness of the world. B.B. Warfield, a famous theologian, said, Jesus approaches Bethany as a champion preparing for conflict, not in cold unconcern, but in fiery wrath against our enemy. He is worked up. He has been drawn into this battle. He knows that it's not safe to go to Jerusalem. And like his disciples said, it's probably going to kill you to come here. And it did. And for him to get Lazarus out of the grave, he's going to have to go in. So he is ready for battle. He's upset. And beyond that, he looks at her and he looks at all of them and he says, where have you laid him? Where have you put my friend Lazarus? And they said, come and see. And then the shortest verse in the Bible, verse 35, Jesus wept. And again, every time I go to a funeral, I think about this because I think at funerals, especially if we lost someone we didn't expect to lose or they were younger, we go, God, where are you? Are you distant and cold and don't you care? Well, this is God not being distant and not being cold and God caring and weeping. And you would think he would just say, hey, don't worry, in 10 minutes, he's going to be back. But instead he weeps, not because he can't do anything, but because he loves them. And he enters in to the brokenness of life. And they all said, see how he loved him. And then, of course, you know, because we're all like this, they said, well, if he loved him so much, why'd he let it happen, right? That's exactly what they say in verse 37. And so in verse 38, Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. By the way, I guess I said I'm a visual person. I was looking at one of my photographic magazines yesterday, and I noticed there's this photographer in New York City named Nicholas Allen Cope, and he decided to do a series of photographs of people in these shrouds. And as I looked at these pictures, I thought that, well, that's probably what, a little bit of what Lazarus looked like. So as we cycle through these, maybe it'll give you a visual image. But it was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. And Jesus said, take away the stone. And then Martha, the A-type controlling personality, says, Jesus, you don't want to do that because, and what she really means, what she really says is, he stinks. It's been 4 days. It's going to smell really, really bad. And Jesus said, didn't I tell you that if you believe, you'll see the glory of God? And they took away the stone. And Jesus looked up and said, Father, I thank you
that you've heard me. I knew you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me. Because Jesus always does things in concert with the Father. It reminds me of Moses when he's in the wilderness in Numbers 20, and God says, Moses, I want you to talk to the rock and make water come out. And Moses didn't do that. He just hit it with a stick as if he was doing it on his own. And Jesus doesn't go, hey, I'm a miracle worker, I'll do them all. He says, I want the Father. I want to do what the Father says. I want the Father to bring Lazarus out. And when he said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. And there's an astonishing amount of power in those words. Some commentator said it's a good thing he said Lazarus, because otherwise everybody would have come out. You know, this week, you know, the North Koreans said they set off a hydrogen bomb. I don't know if they did or not, but, you know, we've been talking about, hey, an atomic bomb is a pretty big deal. And a hydrogen bomb is like 100 times bigger than an atomic bomb. Well, compared to the power of God, that's very little. Jesus has this incredible power to bring someone out of the grave, and the dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. And Jesus said to them, take off his grave clothes and let him go. And I just had to remember what they said one chapter before in John 10. His sheep hear his voice, and he calls them by name, and he leads them out. And one day that's going to happen to you and to me. And we're going to pause now and take communion. And as we do it, we are going to remember that he is the resurrection. He is the life. He is the reason for our hope. And as we take the bread, we're going to remember that he came here and took on a body and became one of us and lived life. Lived the life we should have lived. And when we take the cup, we're going to remember that he shed his blood and he died the death we should have died. And the way we're going to do this is, again, by intinction. And in a moment after I pray, you can get up and go to any one of these four tables and take the bread and the cup. And remember that if you have an allergy to gluten, there's this one over here, this one table on the far left over here, is gluten-free bread. So feel free to go over there. But let's pray together as we think of these things. Jesus, you are so overwhelming and astonishing in your strength and power and courage. You were drawn into a fight, to a place that should not have been fighting you, to a place that should have welcomed you with open arms. We recognize that we're on a broken planet and there is spiritual warfare, and that you came knowing that. You fought for us. You died for us. You rose again. You are the resurrection and the life. We worship you. We cling to you. We find our life in you. Amen.